You're listening to Yes to Employment, a podcast series that seeks to improve competitive integrated employment outcomes for transition-aged youth and young adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. This is the second part of our two-part series on the District of Columbia's Project Action. In part one, the Yes Center's Dale Verstegen talked to Project Action leaders Ricardo Thornton and Thomas Mangrum. Today, Dale continues the conversation about Project Action with Rebecca Salon and Phyllis Holton about their role supporting Project Action's self-advocate leadership.
Dale Verstegen here with Rebecca Salon and Phyllis Holton, who have been involved with Project Action in Washington, D.C., for well over 25 years. Rebecca, can you just define what Project Action is?
Yes, thanks, Dale. So Project Action is a statewide self-advocacy coalition. A small group of self-advocates started meeting in the late 80s and called themselves Advocacy in Action. And really were, for the first time, trying to figure out how to get to some of the tables where decisions were being made about them. The initial group were mostly people who were still living with their families. And then they were joined by a group of other advocates who were part of an adult education program that was cut from the budget. And all of a sudden, they found themselves without this adult education program that they highly valued. That group had a student government, and the student government reached out to Advocacy in Action. They realized that they weren't organized in any way to do anything about the city council just cutting funding for a program. Mm-hmm. So the group came together and realized that they needed more strength in numbers. There were a number of small self-advocacy groups in the city at the time, so the ARC of DC had their own group. There were a number of small groups, but they were all very small. And through that, they decided to come together and be one larger group, so that's how the coalition started, and we were able to get some funding to get them going.
And how long ago was that?
So the coalition probably came together around 1990, so more than 25 years ago. So the smaller groups had been meeting for a couple years at that point. And there are quite a few members who have been involved from the very beginning who are still active.
Great. When and how did Project Action come into its own? I mean, how much support did you have to provide initially, and how did that support change over time?
So I think a turning point for them, and Phyllis Holton, who's with me, can add to this, but they applied for funding from a group called the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, which is a group that focuses on pulling people out of poverty, supporting grassroots community organizing. We were the first disability group that they had ever considered funding, but they actually provided funding for them to start their coalition and engage in planning. And that really was a turning point because they came up with goals, and strategically one of their earlier goals was that they wanted to get to serve on as many boards and commissions and committees and work groups as possible so that people couldn't not consider their point of view. And they knew that if they were at the table, people couldn't ignore them. And that has continued to be their goal and really has made all the difference, because in the beginning, they really were begging to have a place at the table. Now there are more groups that want them to be members than they have members who are ready to serve. Phyllis, what would you add?
I agree. I think that's what has been one of their strengths, just really being a part of different collaborations. over the years, and you know, just relishing those opportunities to share with other groups what's important to them, to have their voice heard. They're incredibly powerful advocates who are not shy a bit, and really will just speak up for themselves and speak up for their peers who aren't as comfortable yet doing that. They're very encouraging of one another to take risk and opportunities that they may not feel they're ready for, but the group really feels that they are. I recall Thelma Green, one of the past co-presidents, most recently saying, you know, I just wanted to come to the meetings and, you know, but you all pushed me and said I should run for an office. I wasn't ready, but she was ready, and they saw that in her, even though she didn't see it in herself.
Phyllis, in those early years, could you give some examples of where they were asked or how they got onto a committee or a board, and what was their role in that committee or board?
I would say in the earlier years, their involvement possibly was on more disability-focused organizations, such as the Developmental Disabilities Council, the Center for Independent Living. And, you know, they were asked to serve on the board. And I think in the beginning, we had to push them more to ask for accommodations so that they could fully participate. I think maybe in the beginning, it was more they were at the table, but they weren't really acknowledged. And, you know, folks didn't really seek their full participation or opinions. And as they grew stronger, they gave it, they shared it. And they would say, oh, you know, what is that? I need that written out before the meeting. I need to come early and have you go over it with me. So really standing up for themselves and requesting the accommodations that they needed and many people with disabilities need to fully participate on boards and committees. You would think in, you know, 2015, 20, whatever, that wouldn't be necessary, but it still is in many organizations. And then I think they developed their own passions. And then they started to seek out opportunities to serve on different boards. So just on, you know, transportation. So they sought out, oh, I want to be on the WMATA Advisory Transportation Board. And they applied. And now they're speaking up there. Or homeownership is important to me. And I want to make sure that, you know, the city leaders know that people with disabilities want to purchase homes just as much as anyone else. And they want to be heard.
Yeah. So for states that want to set up some self-advocacy types of initiatives, how would you characterize the support that they got? Like you talked about some of the accommodations that they needed to be effective in those groups. So what might have your level of support been early on, and how has that changed over time?
I think early on it was possibly more support from Rebecca, but also on the things that, you know, maybe making conference arrangements, finding out some of the things that they needed, because some of them, you know, still don't have the access to the internet printing. That's how many people connect now, you know, and they may not have. So we would do things like printing something out or calling and saying, hey, city council meeting is tomorrow, you know, this time, assisting them to write their testimony. I find, though, that one of the strengths in the collaborations is that they have a wider network now than just Rebecca and I, so that there are more people that they can turn to support them. So I do believe that the level of support has dwindled some in some areas over the years because they have a stronger, wider network, and those people can support them as well. So there are other people that are calling them and saying, it's this or then, can I help you? And I think that has just made their impact in Washington, D.C. and beyond much stronger.
Yeah, it's Rebecca. I mean, I would add that their first, I think, 2 years, we did a really strong focus on what it means to run a meeting, so that before they did their first elections for officers, everyone had an opportunity to co-chair the meeting. And so they learned how to do introductions. They learned how to call for a vote. They learned about the flow of different meetings and had a chance to be that person who called the meeting to order, who got people back on topic. So it was probably 2 years until everyone had a turn. And they jokingly say, we have two of everything. But from the beginning, they've had co-presidents, co-vice presidents, co-secretaries, co-treasurers, co-sergeants-at-arms, so that more people get leadership opportunities. Dale, I know you got to attend one of their meetings, and the first 20 minutes or so of a meeting is everyone getting the microphone and getting to introduce themselves and share so that they're desensitized to talking in front of people. And as Phyllis said, they're just so incredibly supportive of each other, so that even if they're nervous, you know, they have a cheering squad with them that is going to say, I was nervous my first time too, you know, let's practice together. But there's a lot of, you know, just individual support and people getting feedback and having experience. We've done a lot of leadership training. We have done annual conferences. We don't do them every single year, but we, you know, do conferences that bring more self-advocates into it. So we gave them enough time to, you know, really learn the ins and outs of not just being an advocate, but how to serve on a board or committee.
Yeah, and that was my impression when I had a chance to sit in on a Project Action meeting is the level of management of the meeting that was done by the board and its members. And that just doesn't happen for any group, much less incorporating folks with intellectual disabilities in terms of playing that role of officers and running a meeting. And they were very supportive of each other, but I also found that they policed themselves, that it didn't take a support person to try to get them on track, or that they really kind of called each other out if they were getting off track or if somebody was kind of being disruptive. You've been with them for this whole time. How did that level of management occur? I mean, how did they figure out how to do this? Is it just time? Was that just it? Is just exposure and practice running meetings?
I believe so. And I think, you know, as Rebecca said, the support, the consistency. Project Action actually hosts monthly meetings. And prior to their full meeting in the community, we have a agenda setting planning meeting the week before as well. So the executive committee leaders come together one evening and they develop their agenda. So what happened with you this past month, and what will you be, you know, sharing? What will you be sharing? And they have an opportunity there to develop that and share it. And so that's also leading them to running the meeting, because they're setting it themselves. And, you know, just that whole piece that Rebecca referred to of the sharing in the beginning, self-advocates on the move, where they talked about what they did and they invite the audience to do it as well. I think that's just so empowering for everyone, because you get that opportunity to just speak. And that doesn't happen always for people with disabilities.
I would just add that they've set their own ground rules also over time, so that they can police themselves. So they actually, you know, have come up with a really powerful set of ground rules, including the what to do when the person who rambles raises their hand one more time. You know, to either get them on topic or to not make sure that you never roll your eyes, because that's disrespectful, and you don't, you know, kind of make noises that make it sound like that you're not respecting them, but acknowledging that everyone, that other people may not have a place to talk, and that's why they want the microphone, you know, that they, this is a place where they know they're going to be heard. And so they've kind of set their own ground rules to be able to do that, and they do call each other on them if they do go off topic or if they do something that someone might perceive as being disrespectful. And, you know, I think it's great. I wish more committees would do that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I was really impressed that all the leadership of in D.C. for DDA was there, but they were just participating like anybody else. It did not seem that there was any active support being provided. It was just, you were all there kind of as participants. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like a lot of the support happened in advance. It happened behind the scenes. And then when the meeting happened, you guys are just participating, enjoying it just like everybody else was.
Well, and there are, as Phyllis noted, there are supporters throughout the room. So there are usually, you know, several people from Quality Trust, from Disability Rights DC at University Legal Services. Our PNA usually has people there. Our developmental disabilities system and the Department of Disability Services are at the table. Sometimes the DD Council is there. So those are people who have supported them for other things, so that, that and at time when they would be writing testimony for the City Council, you know, people who work for state government can't help them. But there's a whole network of people from the USED at Georgetown and others who make themselves available to help people craft testimony and practice so that they can do that. For many of the years, they didn't have any funding, and it didn't matter. I mean, it meant that they couldn't go to conferences necessarily or things like that, but they've always had an enormous amount of volunteer support to be able to keep them going. And they've also gotten financial support from both disability and non-disability organizations, which has been nice. But whether or not they have funding has not threatened whether or not they get to continue, which is a nice position to be in.
Absolutely. So there's two types of advocacy that I've seen out there. It's family and parent advocacy, and then there's the people themselves in terms of advocating for themselves and each other. Can you talk about that in relation to the development of Project Action and kind of like, was there a role for families and parents early? Is there still now? How would you characterize that?
I think early there wasn't the partnership that there is now, that a lot of families didn't want their sons and daughters coming to this because it meant that they might disagree. That the family may have wanted them to continue to live at home, they wanted to be on their own, or they wanted to be dating, or things like that. So there was some resistance initially, but their development really paralleled the parent advocacy movement, where they started off being very concerned about their own issues, and as Phyllis said, you know, then got to a point where they were representing the interests of other people. And now Project Action members serve on the DC Supporting Families Community of Practice, and they're on the Family Support Council, and vice versa. Family members come to Project Action meetings to see how things develop and encourage their younger sons and daughters to become involved. So it's you know, it's the pendulum has swung up and back a few times, but I think they now, you know, acknowledge that they share many issues and do have a lot of common interests.
We're here at the TASH conference this week, and we've actually brought along approximately 14 self-advocates. We also have three family members that have attended as well, but they're really supporting their, you know, adult son or daughter, and they're also in their, you know, they're part of their fan club, and they want them to do well. And I think then they also, those parents go back, and they are then also advocates and ambassadors for Project Action, you know, talking with other parents to say, hey, this is what, you know, my son or daughter is doing with Project Action. Do you think that, you know, your son or daughter might like to attend a meeting? You know, they're Saturday and they're held here at this time. I think it would be a great opportunity for them. So I think that many of the family members are really great supporters of Project Action. And it's, I think for most of them that I know of, it's a great relationship for the, you know, the child as well as the parent.
Okay, good. So that's kind of how you got to where you are now. How would you describe Project Action now in terms of the makeup of this group, what they're doing on a regular basis?
I think that in the city now, they're a force to be reckoned with. They are truly recognized. As Rebecca said, people are reaching out to them to say, hey, can you be on my committee? Can you be on my board? Council members know them by name. There is legislation that is proposed, and no one really goes much forward with it without saying, oh, what does Project Action think about this? We need to have them at the table. What do they think? They reach back out to them saying, this is where it is now. Is this what you're looking for? Do you still support it? So I think they are, you know, just way years beyond now, and people look to them to kind of really give them the guidance on how they want services to be provided, as it should be.
Yeah, and I think that their monthly meetings, they often get, you know, 50 to 75 people who come to monthly meetings, which is pretty unheard of for self-advocacy groups. And they made a decision early on that they weren't going to be a social group, which is what happens to many self-advocacy groups, you know, that they really had business to accomplish. And they question if people want to put something on the agenda. It's, you know, is that an advocacy issue? You know, that they have things that they do outside of Project Action that allow them to socialize with each other, and they develop great relationships, but they're pretty focused.
Mm-hmm. So accomplishment-wise, can you point to some things that based on the fact that Project Action is in existence and participating with everything that's going on in D.C., there's some things you can point to in terms of what they've accomplished?
Yeah, as Phyllis mentioned that they testify at the city council. They, a few years ago, people who were getting services through the DD system would only get $70 of spending money out of their Social Security benefits, which is inadequate under any circumstances, and people had been talking about it for a long time. They testified at the city council about what it means to only have $70 if you're not otherwise working and have other money, and because they could tell their own stories and make it very real, it got changed. You know, so they were able to make that happen. They testified on behalf of their direct support staff, saying that their staff were underpaid, and this is what it means in my life when my staff turn over, because they can earn more money working at McDonald's. So it wasn't so much that they're being underpaid. Everyone agreed with that. But until they heard that I'm at risk when my staff come and go because they don't know how I communicate, or they don't understand what I need to be safe and healthy, or they don't know what I like and don't like, it made it very real that, you know, it's not just that they're being underpaid, but it's resulting in staff turnover and morale problems. So it, you know, I think that's been powerful. There's about to be passed in the city a Citizens with Intellectual Disabilities Civil Rights Restoration Act that they have been a driving force behind and are helping to design a grievance process for the city. And as Phyllis said, you know, people wouldn't think of moving things forward without getting Project Action's input. So it's very exciting.
Lots of legislation, and I think, you know, just being a presence in the city and having government leaders reach out and acknowledge them and their contribution. And I think just when they accomplish something, they look beyond their own personal accomplishment and look at how they could make that a possibility for others. You know, so one or two of our members actually have purchased their own homes. And they then say, oh, you know, if they hear someone else is interested in that, then they become their greatest advocate. This is what I did. This is who you need to contact, and really kind of, you know, steward them through the process. So I think that's another great accomplishment of theirs.
Great. The future. How do you see the future for Project Action?
I think it's very bright and really limitless. I think one of the things that they're working on right now is reaching out to younger folks in the school system, with other organizations in the city that work with youth with disabilities. They know they've always wanted to reach out to young people and have them be a part of their group. And we've done different things throughout the years to focus on it. But this year, we're actually doing a lot of leadership training in small cohorts over a number of months, having people come in and do different curriculum role plays, working with them to identify what their passions are. And here are some committees that you might want to join. How would you do that? Assisting them through the process. And then also shepherding those people to be more involved with Project Action, to attend the monthly meetings. We actually have three or four people who went through our last leadership training here at the conference with us, and they're doing a presentation on that. But I think that will be a focus, because they can do so much more. As Rebecca was mentioning, there are more boards and committees to serve on than the core group can really do. Mm-hmm. You know, many of them probably are on 4-5 boards or commissions, and, you know, they need more people to do that and to, you know, hear that perspective of other self-advocates as well.
Yeah, and I would agree that they have so much support now that they aren't likely to just go away. I mean, there was a time, I think, when we were worried that if we couldn't support them, the group would fall apart. And I think that that there's no risk of that. You know, that there's strong leadership within the group, and there's a really big support network that is committed to them being successful. So from a sustainability standpoint, I do think that their future is very bright.
Great. Well, we've covered the past and the present and the future for Project Action, and I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk to us about this 25-plus year effort and initiative that you've had, and it's something that I'm sure, but I just want to tell you that you should be very proud of all the work that you've done and what you've been able to put in place. So congratulations.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Yes to Employment, a podcast that seeks to improve competitive integrated employment outcomes for transition-aged youth and young adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. To learn more about Project Action, visit www.dcqualitytrust.org/families/join-project-action. Or you can email Phyllis Holton at pholton@dcqualitytrust.org or call her at 202-448-1458. Project Action meets one Saturday per month at the Kennedy Institute on Catholic Charities, located at 1801 Buchanan Street Northeast, Washington, D.C., 20017. For more about Yes to Employment, including show notes, links to resources discussed, a complete transcript, and a schedule of episodes, visit www.yestoemployment.org/podcast. You can subscribe through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app to have the series delivered automatically to your device so you never miss an episode. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a rating on iTunes. Ratings will help us get the series in front of more listeners. Yes to Employment is a production of the Youth Employment Solutions Center, the National Training and Technical Assistance Center that serves as a hub of information and expertise for the Partnerships and Employment, PIE, state projects. The YES Center is a collaboration of TASH and TRANSCEND. You can learn more about TASH at TASH.org and more about TRANSCEND at TRANSCEND.org. That's TRANSCEN.org. You can receive updates from the YES Center on this podcast and our other activities by following us on Facebook or on Twitter at Yes to Employment. Partnerships in Employment is a series of seed grants funded by the Administration on Community Living's Administration on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, made to states for the purpose of transforming state disability support systems to competitive integrated employment. AIDD is dedicated to ensuring that individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families are able to fully participate in and contribute to all aspects of community life in the United States and its territories. Music for Yes to Employment is an original composition and performance by Sonny Sefirati, the co-director and self-advocacy mentor at The Musical Autist. You can learn more about The Musical Autist at www.themusicalautist.org. Be sure to keep Yes to Employment on your list. We'll have another episode on competitive integrated employment for you in the near future.